You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, September 28th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Clyde Prestowitz, president of the Economic Strategy Institute, on the TPP and our incoherent China policy. Also on the program today, VW CEO paying the price for cheating the EPA regulations. It could cost him up to, well, negative $67 million. In other words, that could be his severance package. $67 million. Not a bad job if you can get it, apparently. Meanwhile, Shell, in a shocking retreat, will end Arctic exploration for oil. Billions down the tubes. And environmentalists played a big role in that. Also on the program today, immoderate extremist Republicans outraged at how immoderate and extremist the Republicans are. Meanwhile, Ben Carson paying the price in the Republican presidential primary race for being bigoted against Muslims shoots up 5 points in the polls. That's the price you pay. And that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. That seems to be the theme, right? If you do something horrible and you're in the right business, it will reward you.
I think I got this. I know I'm slipping in the polls a little bit, but check this out. How about we strip search Muslim boys on their way to middle school?
Boom. Boom. You just jumped up 2 points in the polls.
I think that was a $3 million fundraising haul for the day, and I don't want to be egotistical, but I think I did that pretty well.
Armstrong Williams making an appearance as his campaign manager. We will talk about that later in the program. No, you know, I'm very proud of my history with Armstrong Williams. They shut down my show on, what was it? Was it WLIB? No, WRRL. WRL, Air America. The local station had Armstrong Williams on with Sam Greenfield. And I, not so accidentally, really harped on the whole thing about Armstrong Williams, who back in the day was paid by the Bush administration to promote, or specifically the Department of Education, to promote No Child Left Behind, and without telling people that he had been paid to promote it. Just, I don't know, it would be like the functional equivalent if I was receiving, let's say, a massive check from the Obama administration to hype the Affordable Care Act, and I didn't mention it to anybody, which I would like to make clear, available. we will get to that. Oh, want to mention, this is we've got a great sponsor of the program today. Now, I don't know if this happens with you. It certainly happens with Nikki and I, and we have changed the way that we eat fish. Because Nick was involved in something, I don't know, I guess now 5 or 6 years ago, in a big, I don't know what happened to that program. It stalled for a while, but there was a big attempt to basically save the oceans, like a big a web project. But, you know, you go to the restaurant, you look at the menu, you like what seafood is being presented, but you ask yourself, will my order hurt the planet? Eating wild seafood guilt-free means sorting out the rights, wrongs, and downright scary of the seafood industry. Oceana is here to help. It's a new kind of conservation group dedicated to saving the oceans while feeding the world. Visit oceana.org. That's oceana.org/majority report to join the campaign to bring back healthy wild fish to your plate and to dinner tables all over the globe. I'm convinced that Mila may not be able to eat seafood the way that we have approached just basically draining the oceans. Join now, and Oceana will send a copy of their book, The Perfect Protein. It includes sustainable recipes from top chefs and an easy guide for how to eat seafood responsibly. Find out what wild seafood to order or how to prepare it, so you can keep enjoying the food you love while protecting the planet we share. That's Oceana, oceana.org/majority report. Use that offer code today. Help save the oceans while feeding the world. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Clyde Prestowitz. Today, and in fact, over the weekend, countries who are potential signatories to the TPP have gathered in Atlanta, Georgia, to attempt to close the TPP deal. Clyde Prestowitz has a perspective on this deal on the terms that the Obama administration has sold it to Americans, and that is specifically, we need to do this as part of our Asian pivot. We'll be right back after this.
Take it back.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Clyde Prestowitz, author of The Trail of American Prosperity and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. On his piece in The American Prospect, Our Incoherent China Policy. Welcome to the program, Clyde.
Oh, well, nice to be with you.
So let's start with, well, we should say that the TPP is being negotiated as we speak, and some are arguing that it could be the final round of negotiation in Atlanta. Talk, you start your piece by saying that in the summer of 2009, you were invited with a few other policy analysts to the White House for a briefing on the then newly proposed TPP. Tell us what your first reactions were, or in fact, even before that, tell us what you heard at that time.
Well, I was, as I said, at the White House with several others, and the officials, some of the officials from the National Security Council, wanted to know our reaction to the idea of a TPP. And my reaction was that if you looked at all the countries who were being included, so that was Canada, Mexico, Chile, Peru, New Zealand, Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, Vietnam, we already had free trade agreements with all but Malaysia and New Zealand and Vietnam. And these are all tiny economies. So my question was, well, what's the point? You know, we're not adding, couldn't possibly add very much to the U.S. economy because it's other economies just not big enough. And so the response I got was, well, actually the point of the negotiation was to reassure our Southeast Asian allies that America is back. And I said, yeah, but who said we ever left? You know, we've had the 7th Fleet out here for 75 years. We have 100,000 troops in Asia for the last 75 years. We have an enormous trade deficit with Asia. We do an enormous amount of trade. So, I just didn't get it. I still don't get it, basically.
Well, you know, so, I mean, that is I've heard quite a bit about the Asian pivot insofar as that not only do we have the fleet that you talked about, that we were going to be moving more of our Navy into the Pacific. I mean, before we get into the sort of the folly of the TPP to ostensibly achieve that sense that we are back in Asia, I mean, what drives that idea? I mean, that we need to be back, or that there is a that there is some type of threat emerging from China?
Well, that's the point. It's all really, you know, being concocted with China in mind, I think the thinking of the administration and of many, I'll say the foreign policy elite in the U.S., has always been that somehow, if you can conclude a trade agreement, that somehow that strengthens your alliances, and in this case, will somehow counterbalance China. And as I said in my piece, if you think that, I mean, the first question is, does China need to be counterbalanced? But if you think China does need to be counterbalanced, then this TPP will not do it. And if you don't think China needs to be counterbalanced, well, the TPP won't do that either. So it's kind of a pointless, in my view, kind of a pointless exercise. I mean, what is not being told, Obama goes on television and says that this is somehow going to offset China. Well, at the same, he says that we don't want China to write the rules of trade in the 21st century. Well, what he doesn't say is that even as we're negotiating this deal, I guess now in Atlanta, all of the countries we're dealing with, Singapore, Malaysia, Japan, Korea, they're all negotiating deals with China. In fact, most of them already have free trade deals with China. So what we're doing in this thing is not going to deter China economically in any way. It's just foolish.
All right, I want to dig into this because this is, you know, we have heard a lot of critique of the TPP on the grounds of what it does to labor, what it does in terms of corporations having a mechanism in which to basically strip. Depending on how you perceive it, but strip the sovereignty of nations when it comes to their ability to write environmental regulations and labor and consumer safety regulations, et cetera. But this is really sort of taking the argument on its own terms. And so let's walk through this notion. You've made the point that when we talk about the amount of trade that we're talking about here, it's infinitesimal relative to the GDP. Talk about the U.S. deal to bring China into the WTO in 2001 and the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement of 2012, how these trade deals did not purport to do what they were supposedly set out to do in terms of our dynamic.
Since the mid 1990s, there've been two major deals. One, the negotiation to bring China into the World Trade Organization, the WTO, and the other is a free trade agreement between the U.S. and Korea. And in both cases, and I could add that in many cases before that, but in both of these recent cases, the deals were proposed on a basis that they were going to dramatically reduce American trade deficits, create jobs, and protect U.S. Intellectual property. Now, let's take bringing China into the WTO. In 2001, we had about an $80 billion trade deficit with China. And all of our officials went up to Congress and they said, as soon as we do the deal, that trade deficit is going to drop like a stone. Well, today our trade deficit with China is about $300 billion. And some people calculate that we've lost about 5 million jobs to China over the past 12 or 15 years. More recently, we did a trade deal in 2011, 2012 with Korea. Again, our officials went up to the Hill and they said, this deal is going to cut our trade deal with Korea. We're going to be selling American cars in downtown Seoul. And it hasn't happened. Our trade deficit has jumped dramatically with Korea. I've watched this for 35 years, Sam. The reason that these deals never pan out according to the forecast of our trade policy elite is because the fundamental assumptions of the deals are wrong. We keep assuming that if we sign a trade deal, somehow these markets are all going to begin to look like an American market. And they don't. They don't have the same kind of antitrust restrictions and the same kind of regulation of financial markets. So it doesn't matter what kind of deal you do, they're not going to come out the way that it's predicted.
Clyde, could you just do me a favor, just maybe back off your phone just a little bit, just so that we can get it just a little bit clearer. But the point you're making there is that we have these assumptions that essentially these markets function like our markets, and it's never the case. And you mentioned in the context of our relationship with China that there was an assumption that the currencies would remain, or at least the currency valuations would remain static, and that's also not the case.
Absolutely not.
And so if it's the case, and let's just go through this. You say that China already has free trade agreements with Singapore, Australia, Chile, New Zealand, Pakistan, Peru, Costa Rica, Iceland, Switzerland, right. Korea, on and on. The idea being that this is in no way going to sort of like box China in some fashion. So what, I mean, tell us also the story about what happened with General Electric and with their move to China, because yeah. I think there was some talk of this, but very little. And this story speaks to, I guess, the sincerity in which we should interpret at least articulated motivations behind this deal.
Yeah, well, two things. One is that we have to remember that China, of course, is not in the TPP. We're not negotiating with China. On the other hand, the president keeps talking about the TPP as something that would counterbalance China. And that's where I think the General Electric story is pertinent, because his GE, several years ago, 3-4 years ago, making an announcement that they're going to move their avionics operations into a joint venture with a company in China. And, you know, avionics is something that's not labor intensive. It's high tech. The U.S. is the low cost, high quality location for making avionics. So according to all the laws of economics, the avionics should be done in the U.S. And, you know, we sell them avionics and we import shirts or toys or whatever it is. But what's happening is that the Chinese policy, economic development policy, says to American companies, look, as a condition of allowing you into the Chinese market, you have to transfer your production and your technology to China. And so GE, along with a number of other companies, did that. Now, the irony is that at the same time GE was doing that, GE's chairman was chairman of President Obama's commission on jobs and economic recovery. But I think the larger point is that, again, it comes back to this point I made earlier about the assumptions we make about the nature of our trading partners is often wrong. Because the assumption is if we just have sometimes a trade agreement, that these industrial policies, these technology development policies of other countries will stop. And they don't. And we're not at all curtailing or counterbalancing China as long as we don't deal with the impact of this kind of conditional market entry that China, but not only China, other countries also practice.
You know, the thing that I appreciated about this story about Jeffrey Immelt is that and basically it is essentially the Chinese, you know, almost I don't know if it's blackmail is the right word, but it's basically saying it's leveraging and saying, look, if you want access right. to sell here, you got to right. come here and create jobs here. And right. it's GE basically saying to the United States, bye-bye, we will right. sell it back to you. Probably it may cost a little bit more because now we are constructing these in China. It may not cost dramatically more, but you certainly, we're not going to be investing in the United States. And this is a perfect example of what you say in terms of like, basically we're just growing an industry in China that was not there. And I guess presumably China is saying, hey, if it's not going to be GE, then we will talk to some French company and they'll come
right,
in and
right.
do it. Exactly.
The Chinese are playing the companies off against each other. But I think the key factor here that has to be understood is that a guy like Jeff Immelt at GE in Washington is a powerful political player. He can come to Washington. He has his lobbyists. He has his law firms. He has his publicists. He can meet with the president. He can meet with top officials. He's a player in Washington. In Beijing, he's a supplicant. He has no power in Beijing. He's a supplicant. He gets down on his knees. And that's not just true of Jeff. It's true of all of the leading American CEOs. I mean, we just saw the president of China, Xi Jinping, you know, came here on a state visit. But before he came to Washington, he stopped in Seattle to conduct a high-tech summit in the United States. And who was there? Well, the head of Apple, the head of Facebook, the head of Microsoft. I mean, all the key top U.S. CEOs went to Seattle to sit at the feet of Xi Jinping during this day's visit. And all of them are supplicants. I mean, the Chinese don't even allow Facebook in the country. Nevertheless, Mark Zuckerberg goes up, knows a few phrases in Chinese to try to impress Xi to let him in. At the same time, some of the top Apple officials have made the statement that Apple has no responsibility for for supporting American policy. So you have this crazy unbalanced situation in which the powerful CEOs are powerful in the U.S. and yet they feel that they don't have any particular responsibility to the U.S. In fact, they feel they have maybe more responsibility to China because, as I said, they're supplicants in China.
Well, so that raises the $64,000 question. There's another question, a subsidiary question that I want to address afterwards. And we want to sort of swing back around to any threat that that China may or may not pose to us, but that's like a $32,000 question. The $64,000 question in my mind is, when you are brought in 2009, and when we have Michael Froman writing pieces about how the TPP is going to sort of set the table and show our allies that we're going to be a player in Asia and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or that this is going to take us into the 21st century in terms of trade, whatever the arguments are the people offering these arguments, are they just ignorant to what you've laid out here or what other people will argue against the TPP, or are they just basically trying to grasp at any justification they can so that they can offer a trade agreement that is frankly much more conducive to the interests of certain corporate interests rather than some type of national interests?
Yeah, no. To be fair to them, I don't think that they're bought and paid for by U.S. corporate interests. I mean, the attitude that you mentioned Mike Froman's name, but the views that Mike has are widely shared. Those are the majority views. I'm a minority. I'm considered an outlier. The foreign policy elite, I mean, the academics, the lawyers, the bankers, the industrials, all the people who, let's say, are members of the Council on Foreign Relations, they have a long-established view that free trade is always win-win. And even if you open your market and the other guy doesn't open his market, he's only hurting himself. This is widely established. This is what we teach in our universities. So, you know, to be fair to the proponents of that view, I don't think that they're disloyal or that they're bought and paid for. I just think they're wrong.
Well, okay, but let me put it this way. Okay, they may believe it's win-win, but who's winning? In other words, when we talk about the United States, China, and GE, there's three parties involved. And
right.
I would bet that maybe it is win-win. But again, there are three parties involved. and there's only two. You know, we've only mentioned two wins. I would argue it's win, lose.
Look, I think that you have to understand that a guy like Jeff Bezos, the head of a major global corporation, you know, global corporations are typically the location of their incorporation. They're incorporated in America or in Germany. And we think of them as American firms, as German firms, as Chinese firms. That's old-fashioned. It's the wrong way to think. These guys are not – the companies don't have a national loyalty. If you run a global corporation, your job is to maximize the wealth that that corporation produces. And you play on a playing field. And the way the playing field is organized today, it allows some of the players, like China, to play by rules that other players don't play by. I mean, so it's like China's playing football and we're playing baseball. And GE has got to figure out how to play football with the Chinese and baseball with America. And so that's Jeff's job. I don't think Jeff is, you know, disloyal as an American because he did what he did with China. But I do think that the United States is terribly, terribly mistaken in fostering an environment that propagates this set of double rules.
I am perfectly willing to at least accept the premise that to accept the premise, I mean, in an unqualified way, that Jeff Immelt, his job is to maximize the value for GE. And for him, it's not a question of being disloyal to one country or another. It's he is from the nation of GE, as it were. And that's what his job is.
Yeah.
But here's the part that I think is it becomes problematic. While he is from the nation of GE, he is also chairing the American Council on Jobs and Competitiveness.
Those
don't seem to be aligned agendas, right? Because
That's right. No, he has in that he's no longer the chairman of the Council on Jobs. But at that moment when he was, he had a conflict of interest, yeah.
Right. And, I mean, it seems to me that, maybe I've just gotten too cynical, but I'm quite convinced that after TPP is done, Michael Froman will be working at a company that is doing quite well because certain markets have been opened or certain regulatory structures have been locked in place, which will add to the future profitability of a corporation that I imagine, and maybe I'm, and I'm, I hope I could be proved wrong, that Michael Froman will be working for, which is not to say that that's Michael Froman's agenda, but it is to say that it's so predictable maybe.
Well, he'll make out well. Because as part of his job, he's gotten to know the key players. So he has access, and he is he's in a favored position in this current globalization structure. But I don't believe that Mike is purposely, kind of manipulating the globalization structure to get himself a good job.
No, I mean he's swimming in an ocean where these are the physics and where it's very hard to see how maybe other parties are not rewarded in a structure in which you are rewarded. I mean, I understand all that. I mean, that is I don't need to it's not. I'm not trying to impugn specific individuals, but to say rather that there is it seems to me that there's more at play here than simply you saying 2 plus something equals something else, and them saying 2 plus something equals something else. Because I don't even want to, but it there is a fundamental, I think, bias towards these things, which, you know, as you say, the data shows have not been beneficial to the country, and that there is a bias towards what is good for businesses is really the only analysis that you need to make.
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't disagree with that. I guess what has been troubling me for a very long time is, you know, we keep, what, it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, on these issues, they basically have followed the same policies for a very long time. And it's clear, it seems to me, it's clear that the policies haven't worked. And yet, our leading universities continue to teach this stuff. Our foreign policy elite continues to embrace it. And so I think you have a point, which is that the elite is doing pretty well. And so even if they don't have ulterior motives, they have no reason to change things because they're doing okay. And what's not being taken into account is what's happening to the average guy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I feel like maybe we're saying the same thing in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
I mean, because again, it's like you say, it seems there are certain ideologies or perspectives or strategies that seem immune from real world data. Yeah. And at that point,
it's a good analogy.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but here's a good analogy. Now, the famous physicist Max Planck, back in the 1920s and 30s, he was propagating very new views of physics. And he was swimming against the tide. And he made this great comment. He said that science advances one funeral at a time. You know, meaning that basically all the old professors and all the old researchers had to die before the new views could take hold. Sometimes I feel the same way about trade policy.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to see past how a trade policy that benefits those who are in the position to make it, but not really anybody else, gets changed. Well, so let me just go to that subsidiary question again about China, because there's another story about China, it seems to me, that has been brewing for some time, and there are people. I mean, aside from this not being an effective counterbalance to China's growing strength, it's quite clear that China has been very aggressive in investing around the world. I met a guy from Jamaica the other day, who was saying that, you know, everything is Chinese in Jamaica now.
Right.
Ethiopia, I was there 20 years ago, almost 15 years ago, and anything that was being built by the Chinese. This is to what extent, and you also hear some rationale or some discussion that the neocons perceive China to be the biggest threat to the United States long term, which I imagine is driving, you know, if we need to respond to China, it's because we're in some quarters of our government feel that China is some type of threat. Tell me your perspective on that. I mean, is China some type of threat, existential or otherwise, to the United States? Other than that, maybe they will entice companies like GE to transfer businesses that were unique to the United States, basically give it over to China.
Well, look, two things. Well, I do not believe that China is an existential threat to the United States. I don't believe that China will or wants to invade America or invade any major American ally. I don't see it that way. Now, China is pursuing both a political and an economic system that are at odds with our interests, but we're facilitating them in doing that. So, in a sense, China does threaten us, but it threatens us because, maybe I should state it a different way. I mean, I think the biggest threat to us is us.
Right.
You know, that we don't recognize the disadvantage to which we're putting ourselves when we do things like TPP. We can't blame the Chinese for taking advantage of the stupidities that we do. But they do take advantage of them, and then that puts us in a relatively weaker economic position. And then we flail around and try to figure out what to do about it. And typically what we do is we say, oh, we need another free trade agreement. And then we go and do the same thing all over again. So, you know, our biggest enemy is us.
Clyde Prestowitz, the author of The Trail of American Prosperity. The piece is Our Incoherent China Policy in this fall issue of The American Prospect. Thank you so much for your time today.
Nice
really
to
be with
you. Thanks, Sam.
Bye-bye.
I'll see you later. Bye-bye.
The best is a phone sound the whole time was when he said goodbye. Did you notice that?
He came in crystal clear there.
Yeah, I know. I want to apologize, folks, for the quality of the phone call, but the his perspective on this I found fascinating, and it's a fascinating piece, and I hope you're able to make out what Clyde was saying. I think he was talking on a Skype phone. It sounded like that. Skype phones, the bane of our existence, ladies and gentlemen. The bane of our existence here. But, and, you know, Atreos used to put on his blog all the time, like, stupid or evil? Stupid or evil when you face these questions. And increasingly, I am coming to the conclusion that it's not really relevant. It's interesting to know whether or not people who push something like this are stupid or evil. It's interesting, but at the end of the day, it's largely irrelevant because they respond to the same stimuli. The solution to the stupidness is the same as the solution to the evilness. I'm obviously painting with a broad brush here, folks. But that is pushback. And it is pushback in the form of not just protests and petitions and whatnot, but also, you know, electorally to a certain extent. I mean, I'm quite convinced that if we had three or four more progressive senators in the Senate, maybe five, we would not be looking at fast-track authority granted on that will ultimately allow for the TPP. Now, we also know, I mean, this cuts a couple of different ways, right? Because it seems to me that it's conceivable that if the deal is somehow closed now, I think that's either a 60 or 90 day timeline until it has to come before Congress. And if that's the case, and I don't know for sure, and I don't know if anybody knows, because I would imagine this is going to be manipulated. But the worst case scenario for proponents of this deal is that it comes before the Senate prior to Iowa or prior to New Hampshire. From the perspective of people who want this deal killed, of which I am one, to have it come up in the context of this particularly Republican presidential primary is key, because Donald Trump has already said he's come out against it. Ted Cruz has already come out against it. You've got Rand Paul still in the race. I don't know if he still will be. But it could have some influence. I mean, Lindsey Graham's going to do what Lindsey Graham does. I mean, he's down at 1%. He doesn't need to, pretend. But it's going to be interesting because, one has to wonder even what happens in the House to a certain extent without without Boehner there. I mean, this could get very interesting. On some level, I would almost rather it pass, it come up for a vote now rather than sort of like meander down the road and come up, I don't know, over the summer when you've got, I don't know. Well, if it's Ted Cruz, it's Ted Cruz, but you really want this to get involved in Republican presidential primary politics if you want this thing scuttled. And really, short of, I'm sure that we have some industry attorneys or some people who listen to this program who are just itching for something like this. But beyond that, I imagine most of you also want this sunk because there's really no other reason for it other than if you're going to specifically make money off it, it seems to me. Folks, speaking of making money off it, we have a wonderful offer for you. Become a member of the Majority Report today. And if you do become a member of the Majority Report today, you will be a member tomorrow. For just pennies a day, ladies and gentlemen. Something like 33 pennies. I wouldn't suggest you walk around with 33 pennies in your pocket. But you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Sign up today. Get rid of those pennies out of your pocket. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, thank you to all of you who have given ratings and reviews and have subscribed to Sportocracy. This is the first of several podcasts that we are going to be launching in hopes of basically creating a side business which will support this program. We have the technologies, the know-how, the audience. So the idea is that we launch these other programs and they will support this program in various different ways. It'll help us grow the audience for this program. It will help us provide revenue for this program, which will then help us grow the program. So if you go to iTunes and search Sportocracy, it's like Sportocracy. We have a link on the homepage at majority.fm. Or if you even search, I think, majority.fm in iTunes, you'll find it. Subscribe to it, even if you're not a fan of sports. Well, first off, I think we've gotten great response to the podcast. I've gotten emails from people who are like, I've been waiting for a podcast like this. I've also gotten emails, I don't like sports, but I'm still going to subscribe because I know it helps the show and I don't need to listen to it because I don't like sports. But sports people have written in and said, this is the sports talk show I've been waiting to hear. So check it out. Leave a rating, leave a review if you like the show. And it helps because by all of you subscribing and leaving these ratings and reviews, it goes into the what's hot and new section. And even if you don't use iTunes, there's no other, podcasts are still so nascent. There's no other mechanism, marketing mechanism more powerful than to be on the top charts of iTunes. For better or for worse, that's what we're left with right now. That's probably going to change over the next couple of years, but for now, that's the situation. So you can actually help us. You are our marketing budget. So thank you to those who have done that. And if you haven't, please do. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. The number, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of this program. You can IM me. You can reach us through the app. You can pick that up for free at majorityapp.com. Tomorrow on this program, via telephone, because she's like, don't you want to wait till I can come in? I'm like, no, it's been too long since we've spoken. My old friend, Janine Garofalo, will be on the program via phone tomorrow. We'll be right back after.